instinctual gratification. To pick up the cross, that means to voluntarily face the reality of mortality and malevolence, and to struggle uphill nonetheless. To gain the whole world and lose his own soul, that is the substitution of the lie and what it offers for genuine participation in the creative process, the logos, that engenders everything truly desirable in the best possible manner. This denying and bearing of maximal burden, this is the pathway of the most desirable responsibility and ultimate meaning. It is also the pathway to the kingdom of heaven, truly, and the pathway that is as meaningful as journey as it is as destination. Who could have possibly guessed that willingly accepted responsibility to bear the heaviest of loads is precisely what gives to life its sustaining purpose, creates the world, and sets it straight when it has deviated in its orbit? This is why the Christ who redeems is also the Spirit that takes the sins of the world upon itself. John 1:29, 2 Corinthians 5:21. The essence of man in God is the will to take on the heaviest possible burden of life. How could it be any other way? How could any difficult problems otherwise ever be solved, even admitted to? And is it not the case that those who take it upon themselves to admit to and then solve such difficult problems, aiming upward, allied with the Spirit of love and truth, appear as a blessing to themselves, as the founder of dynasties, as a blessing to others, and as confounders of their enemies? Are they not the people who live the lives that we wish in our most courageous moments to live? Are they not the people that wise men and women strive to imitate, attracted as we are to those who properly make order out of chaos? Are they not, therefore, emissaries or avatars of the Spirit that moves eternally over the waters and determines to attend and to speak productive words and to act? All this seems obvious once explicitly considered, and the conclusions thereby inevitably reached can be buttressed in their foundational certainty by the consequence of weighing the alternative and opposing hypothesis that success in the world comes to those who shrink away, hide, waffle, prevaricate, and avoid. No one believes that. Even when they do such things, no one offers that as the most desirable strategy of life to anyone they truly love and wish, therefore, to encourage. No one believes or even claims to believe that running away and lying is equivalent to what is admirable and good. What is characterized as God in the Abrahamic account is the Spirit that eternally says, in essence, even to the unwilling, you must leave the comforts of your tent, your home and family, and journey into the terrible world. God is that which compels us outward. Is that a spirit to believe in? That depends entirely on what is meant by believe. The pragmatic choice is stark. When the voice of adventure makes its appearance, it can either be listened to and followed, which is what believed in truly means in such a context, or it can be ignored. It is instructive to note that in such a situation, either choice is a matter of faith, as the consequences are equally unspecified in both cases. Furthermore, and this is a true indication of what believe truly means, faith in one or the other is not indicated so much by declarative statement, I believe in, as by action. The man who believes in the spirit of adventure is the one who hits the road. Belief is, in this sense, best revealed by commitment, all-in commitment, determination to trod the path of maximal encounter and comprehensive maturation. The man who fails to do so merely indicates by his inaction or avoidance his equally faith-based belief, but in the spirit diametrically opposed to progress, in the one that calls to continued infantile dependence. There is no non-faith choice in the decision to move forward or not. The former is the sacrificial pathway of ever-expanding horizon. The latter is a deadening and stagnating stasis of spirit. This was Abram's life before the call of God, the beckoning of great opportunity, even the appeal of conscience. And what happens when the promised adventure commences? Abram is first called to the land of the Canaanites. The 19th century biblical commentator Jay Benson describes Canaan as a country given up to the most gross, cruel, and barbarous idolatry, even the sacrificing of their own children. The Canaanites are, by tradition, the children of Cain. The land they inhabit is a false dominion because the habitation is established and continued in the wrong spirit, the spirit of false sacrifice, resentment, and the desire to deceive and usurp. What does it mean that God calls Abram to journey there? It means that every sojourner called forth by the spirit of adventure will suffer exposure to the full gamut of human sin and cruelty, and that such exposure must somehow be managed, even turned into part of the adventure. This point is repeated when the hero of our current story journeys into the absolute depths of depravity, characterizing the doomed cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Why is this all necessary? Because the world is fallen. Because the world is real. Because man has something genuine to do. Where there is no challenge, no limits, there is no impetus upward, no growth, no development, even nothing real. The meaninglessness of such situations signifies exactly that. Obstacles make things real. Limits, constraints, and dangers make things real. Maybe death itself is necessary to make things real. Then the question arises, if the cost of reality is death, how might reality manifest itself to justify that price? That is the ultimate question. With the paradisal dream providing the impossible answer, God provides an intimation with the initial call. If the requirement to strive forward in the world is accepted, the reward is limitless, a life well lived, the establishment of a genuine and stellar reputation, the founding of a nation, and a blessing on the entire world. Is that sufficient to pay for death? There is no a priori answer. That is the curse of the true existential dilemma. Is it worth it? You are fated to find out along the way. What way? That is the eternal question. Abram does not sojourn alone. He is accompanied not only by his loyal and loving wife, Sarai, and his brother's son, Lot, but by God himself. Every time the prophet stops, furthermore, he consecrates his dwelling place to what is highest. He does this to sharpen and maintain his aim, buttress the spirit of adventure, to remind himself of his commitment, and to fortify his faith. God inevitably responds with an insistence on the integrity of and reality of his covenant. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "Unto thy seed will I give this land." And there builded he an altar unto the Lord, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. Genesis 12:7-8. This is the calling forth of the God within, so to speak, to aid Abraham in his struggles with the manifestations of God without. Something unfolds inside the courageous sojourner that makes him the equal of his challenges as he strives forward in faith with the determination to face his fate honestly and completely. This continual sacrifice, marking the onset of a new chapter in the continuing story of adventure, is also something akin to the consecrating the firstborn to God, as discussed previously. Whenever a novel undertaking is conceived, whenever something new is beginning, it is necessary to reconsider both aim and intent. In what spirit is the next opportunity to be undertaken? Is it not necessary to reestablish the upward aim and swear to make the appropriate sacrifices to ensure that everything is in proper alignment, that no bitterness, resentment, falsity, or spirit of pride is replacing the highest possible purpose? A similar tack is taken by all the true prophets and holy men. All of their actions and utterances are consecrated to God. This is the same thing as a reminder of the truth that is true adventure. Do we perform any similar rituals today? Do we regularly consult the highest spirit within us? Do we try to direct every glance and every action to the ends we have determined should reign supreme? And is the alternative not a dreadful weakness, anxious confusion, indecisiveness, a cowardly lack of hope, and an encroaching vengeful cynicism? This is a detail of critical import. The risk of the adventure is absolute, given the undeniable and ever-present reality of death and evil. Such a risk cries out for the accompaniment of an infinite ally. Does such an ally exist? The question is ill posed. The proper question is as follows: what spirit of endeavor can be relied on in the time of greatest crisis? None is an utterly unacceptable answer. In that case, there would be no aim or motivation, which is not a desirable state of affairs when catastrophe looms. Further, the absence of conscious alignment with the spirit that integrates the psyche and brings harmony to the social world leaves us without defense against the spirits of temptation that will instead strive to dominate. When attention must be prioritized and action undertaken, no atheism is possible. Something must be elevated and all other things sacrificed. Abram, building his altars to God, is striving to best ensure that he maintains his alignment with the divine calling that brought him out of his hiding and guides him properly forward. Is this merely another variant of the superstitious search for illusory security that is hypothetically key to the religious endeavor, the opiate of the masses? Not in the least. It is precisely the faithful willingness to sojourn forward that catalyzes the process of internal development. And by voluntarily taking on the new challenge, makes the adventurous hero more than he would have otherwise been. What is the upper limit to that? That is the limit only defined by the ever-receding and ineffable unity occupying the highest rung on Jacob's infinitely upward-reaching ladder. Subjection to this demanding, strengthening, and ennobling developmental process is neither false superstition nor infantile comfort. Quite the contrary. It is instead the certain consequence of the bravest possible life, the result of the radical acceptance, the veritable open-armed welcoming of the entire panoply of even the most dire fate. What happens as Abram continues to open himself to the call? He encounters a never-ending vista of expanding opportunities. one challenging escapade after another. Each of those new ventures, however, requires a sacrifice of previous comfort, of previous commitment or aim, of previous identity. This is the pattern of individual development. Each opportunity requires a corresponding increment of maturity, a sacrifice of something that is now insufficient to the challenge at hand. Each sacrifice, in its turn, makes way for a new and ever-improved identity. This is a process of succession that is identical to the ongoing maturation and expansion of competence, psyche, and community. Each of those new and expanded identities must reaffirm their commitment to the spirit that is properly put in the highest place. Hence, the repetitive acts of altar building and offering engaged in by the burgeoning prophet and father of mankind. Abram is striving to do the right thing at the right time in the right place, so that heaven and earth fall into the kind of alignment that we all experience, albeit rarely and with difficulty, when life proceeds in a manner that is musical, even dance-like, in its unfolding. Abram's life is therefore portrayed a sequence of sacrifices, each more exacting than the last, in keeping with the existential fact that each vista of increased opportunity and responsibility requires a sojourner whose aim is ever more precise, culminating in a transformation so complete that it requires a new name for its proper signification. This is how the life of every individual could unfold if it unfolded completely. As our domains of mastery grow, we must increasingly let go of who we were so that we can become who we could more completely be. The Apostle Paul writes, "When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things." 1 Corinthians 13. Even though it is God who calls Abraham forward, the results are, in a sense, catastrophic, at least by the standards of the original personality. Abram's travails find their mere beginning with the degeneracy and enmity of Canaan, which is soon overcome, unsurprisingly, by famine. Why unsurprisingly? Because the descendants of Cain cannot make the land fertile or establish the means of distribution properly. Why? Because the polity they established is founded not on the divine logos or in covenant with God, but on resentment, pride, deceit, and the desire to usurp. The most fruitful plain or garden imaginable will soon become a desert inhabited by the starving if the highest conceivable ethos does not govern those who inhabit it. Abram is forced by the terrible circumstances characterizing the failed state of Canaan to journey once again, this time to Egypt, where the beauty of his wife poses a new and deadly threat, and perhaps an opportunity, however perverse. And it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai, his wife, "Behold, now I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee." And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. Genesis 12, 10 to 14. We're only several paragraphs into the story, and Abram and his family have already encountered a daunting range of life's horrors: corruption, starvation, authoritarian tyranny, and the covetous demands of a narcissistic aristocracy. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Genesis 12:15. What troubles might befall any man with a beautiful wife, particularly when journeying with her through a strange land? The interest taken in her by the rich and powerful. Who are those princes? What havoc are they capable of wreaking? What might they have to offer? What kind of interest are they, in fact, manifesting? Perhaps the Pharaoh of the time, to whom Sarai was delivered, was a chaste man, despite the fact of his harem. There is no getting around certain facts, however. First, that the Pharaoh had an interest that was essentially carnal, although he apparently planned to marry Sarai, insofar as incorporation into a harem constitutes a marriage. Second, that even if Abraham did not offer his wife for the gain that was in any case pressed on him, he did so equally reprehensibly from fear. Third, that he later repeated that sin, betrayal of his wife, and sequence of deceit almost identically. The entirety of the later Genesis 20 contains an account of a very similar sequence of events surrounding one King Abimelech, who, like the Pharaoh, is warned by God not to sin in consequence of Abram's lies. It is clear in the second case that Sarai escapes the clutches of the king who desires her, but it is not at all obvious in the first case, and it was certainly at least a risk. The Pharaoh takes Sarai and rewards Abram materially, and he entreated Abram well for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. Abram's lies apparently work. He does survive, although he might have anyway, and he does benefit economically. But they only work temporarily, and they carry risks of their own, which is the case with all lies, no matter who tells them, and no matter who becomes tangled up in them. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidst thou, 'She is my sister,' so I might have taken her to me to wife? Now, therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way." Genesis 12:17-19. The visitation of plagues described in these short verses, of course, foreshadows the visitation of 10 calamities in Egypt during the time of Moses. And the meaning is the same. There is a divine pattern that stabilizes and encourages individual and community alike. Deviations from that pattern have deadly consequences. No one is exempt from that iron law, least of all stiff-necked tyrants. And all tyrants are stiff-necked. That is key to the nature of tyranny. Abram is thus now compelled to leave Egypt. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had. Genesis 12:20. It is somewhat surprising that the Pharaoh, whom Abram so feared, does not kill him on account of his lies and the danger they pose to the ruler of Egypt and his house. Perhaps the apparently somewhat prudent head of state decides that neither Abram nor Sarai are worth any further trouble. Abram does not come across particularly well in this episode. What are we to make of this? The simplest explanation is that he is not a thoroughly, and perhaps not even a particularly, good man at the beginning of his story. Does that make his story less or more believable? Who is wise enough to be good when they first embark on their adventure? Abram is an everyman in a profound sense. He has all the faults of someone real, with all the opportunity of someone who could yet become more than he is. What would have happened if Abram had dared to tell the truth, the whole truth, moreover, and nothing but the truth? He certainly had reason to believe that he would have been killed. When you are asked to give up your sister by the absolute monarch, "No, thank you, sir," is not an answer that is within your range of easy choices. The greatest prophets of all time do indeed later dare to tell their kings what they do not wish to hear, and sometimes to save and redeem those very kings along with all their people. But the risk that such monarchs present is real, and so is the potential benefit of lying to them in consequence, and people have betrayed those they love for lesser reasons than those of wealth and life. This is not to excuse Abram's acting in fear or worse, but to indicate his all-too-human nature and the realism of its portrayal in the biblical account. At this point in his journey, Abram simply lacks the sophistication to negotiate his way forward without relying on deceit when he finds himself in over his head. This does not make what he does moral, but it does make it understandable. Who dares proclaim the virtue to stand against tyranny on pain of death? That is a rare ability indeed, certainly not something characteristic of the common man. Such a complex blend of strength and weakness on the part of the biblical protagonists is part of what makes these ancient stories both sophisticated and great, makes them true literature rather than propagandistic entreaty and delusion. Can a man capable of great things also be capable of great faults? No man at all would be great otherwise. There's also something deeper happening here, which we can be blinded to when apprehending the apparent faults of the somewhat deceitful, craven, and opportunistic Abram. Although there is a substantive threat posed to him by the fact of the Pharaoh's interest in Abram's wife, who is in fact also his half-sister, strangely enough, as indicated in Genesis 20:12. The end consequence of exposure to this danger is a palpable increase in Abram's wealth. What could this possibly mean? First, most broadly, the eternal truth: where dragons lurk, treasure is always to be found. What this means in the realm of concrete practicality is that the man who swears to aim upward and is diligent in that pursuit is in the best position to turn challenge, even of the dangerous kind, into positive opportunity. This is a helpful thing to know when adversity comes knocking, as it inevitably will. A question then should usefully spring to mind and potentially alter the entire framing of the event and modify all the attendant emotions. What possible advantage might there be in this difficulty, which has emerged so suddenly and unexpectedly, even unjustly? Job manages something like this and experiences a dramatic reversal of misfortune near the end of the account of his travail. Job 42:10-17. Such transformation is presented in its archetypally ultimate form in the Passion of Christ, the reward granted to Jesus for his embrace of betrayal, pain, mortality, and hell is the kingdom of heaven and the triumph over death and evil. It is God himself, and this, take note, is another description or characterization, as Milton states, who can take even what is ultimately aiming at evil and turn it into a positive good, while Satan strives to do the reverse. To do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight, as being contrary to his high will, whom we resist. If then his providence out of our evil seek to bring forth good, our labor must be to pervert that end, and out of good still to find means of evil. Milton, Paradise Lost. God is the voice that calls us out into the terrible world, guides our way forward, if we maintain our covenant with it. Such is the hypothesis presented here. Would Abram not have revealed himself as an even weaker man than he is, with his half-deceptions, perhaps even fatally weaker, had he rejected the call to move out into the world entirely at the outset of the story? He is, indeed, a bit faint-hearted and greedy at the beginning when he encounters the desirous Egyptian prince, but he is just getting his legs beneath him. Can he be forgiven for not being all he might be before accruing exactly the experience that would help him become so? Who among us is not both lacking courage and immaturely materialistic at the beginning of our sojourn? And once again, let us consider the call to leave security and pursue adventure, identified with the very Spirit of God at the beginning of the story. Do we not reward exactly the proclivity to heed that call among our children, at least insofar as we truly love them? Do we not encourage their independence, their willingness to take risks, even though we understand that they will make mistakes because of fear and avariciousness along the way? Why not just keep them safe? We are doing plenty of that now, and it is not evident that the consequences are any increase in true safety or even felt security. We admire households in which the spirit that governs is that which calls parent and child alike into the world with a dauntless and ambitious confidence. That admiration is a kind of celebration, a form of worship. Admiration compels imitation, and there is no higher form of belief in than imitation. Encouragement of forthright sojourning forward is in keeping with this fact, as much as doing so personally. Both are higher order moral virtues. Higher order because they rule over safety, security, dependence, and hedonistic gratification. Higher order because they subordinate what is demanded in the present, the wish for safety, for example, to the longer-term strategy of functional independence and an accompanying generous productivity. Is it not better to make someone self-sufficient than to endlessly provide them with what they need? If adventure is the point of life, endless provision is not compassionate good, and it does not bring about the promised utopia. It is instead the unconscionable theft of destiny and the unconscious invitation of that comprehensive tyranny that is inevitable when the responsibility is abdicated. Now and then you encounter someone, if you are fortunate, who has had a true adventure, and you find yourself thinking, oh my God, I wish I could have had that. And if you heeded the call, perhaps you could have. My only sister, Bonnie Keller, is an interesting case in point. She is the only person I know who has had physical altercations with representatives of four of the major primate groups. Human, that would be with the author of this work, bonobo, gorilla, and baboon. Bonnie packed herself away from home when she was 18 years old. She left Fairview, our small northern Alberta place of origin, and went 1,000 kilometers away alone to university in Saskatchewan, the Canadian province immediately to the east. Everyone, including her, believed that she was ready, that she was mature enough for the task. She had certainly been a lot less trouble than her older brother when she was a teenager, in any case, and appeared grown up as a result. But Bonnie was not as thoroughly prepared to leave home as everyone assumed. She left for her adventure and could not handle it. Alone, distant from home and its sheltering familiarity, she became anxious, unsure, and depressed, and returned to her parents. This did not please my father, who was first very surprised, as he did not see this coming, something also true of my mother. Second, concerned that she was giving up prematurely, and finally, more than willing to make his displeasure known. The enabling of dependency, it should be noted, is not admirable mercy. Quite the contrary. It is betrayal of the true spirit of the benevolent patriarchy itself. Perhaps my father was harsher than necessary in response, and perhaps not. One thing is certain, Bonnie did come to fortify herself once again and leave for good, and my father had something to do with that. Now, so did my mother, who let her daughter know when she returned home that although she was always both welcomed and loved, her sooner rather than later mature departure was nonetheless the best conceivable outcome. There is obviously some laudable security in such welcoming, and sometimes of precisely the sort that can provide the foundation for a second effort, So good for Mum, particularly given her simultaneous wish for a successful second launch. Bonnie indeed left again after making some real efforts to right herself while at home, where she found a job and enrolled in some distance education classes, despite the real misery she was suffering. Soon thereafter, she returned to the university, this time in central Alberta itself, somewhat closer, but far away enough, rather than Saskatchewan. During a foreign language class she took there, another and more dramatic opportunity presented itself, the possibility of a summer job in Norway on a strawberry farm. Our family happens to be of Norwegian extraction on my father's side, so that country had some particular personal attraction. My father primarily spoke Norwegian at home when very young, in his log cabin on the frigid expanses of the Saskatchewan plains, where his grandfather had homesteaded, broke the land, and established a family in the same farming community where my paternal grandmother was known for the thoroughly Scandinavian lefse potato bread she baked and the oof-does she frequently uttered. My father wagered Bonnie $200, a fair bit of money in the early 1980s, that she could or would not go through with her summer plans. Was this a cruel bet or an act of encouragement? It was certainly a challenge, and it made her angry. Anger, by the way, inhibits fear. She thought something akin to, "Up yours, old man," and took him up on his wager. Then away she went, as promised. And she did not move home again. She broke the shackles of dependency this time in one fell swoop. Bonnie returned to Fairview for a visit months later, much more experienced, harder and wiser, much more mature and adult. She then trained successfully as a nurse. The pursuit of that career enabled her to find employment anywhere, something her newfound and hard-earned confidence made it easy for her to do. Bonnie got every single job she ever applied for after that, not least because she would tell her potential employers, and truthfully, that she knew what she was doing and that they would never regret hiring her. That is music to a potential employer's ears, part of the results of hearkening to the spirit of adventure and God's honest truth in Bonnie's case. Nursing is a hard job and a real one, and my sister learned a lot doing it. After receiving her certification, she traveled to Africa and began working with a British ex-army officer, whom she eventually married. They ran safaris on the savannah for almost 5 years, taking care of often naive and sometimes spoiled North American and European tourists, dealing with the unexpected exigencies of animal and human alike as they made their way through the back trails and the bush. It was during that time that she tangled with a baboon that had made its way into her ramshackle hotel room, chasing it out, if I recall correctly, with a blow from her fist on its muzzle. After the safari ventures came to an end, she and her husband bought Mercedes trucks in France and smuggled them in convoys across the Sahara Desert to Niger to sell them until the Tuareg tribesmen who lived in the intervening territory made the trek too dangerous. Then she applied for a job serving as nurse to orphaned baby gorillas in the Congo. It was there she had the two remaining battles with top primates. The first was with an ill-tempered bonobo that had been placed under her care in a clinic. The second, more serious, occurred in the wild when Bonnie found herself under attack along with a co-worker after trying to return three adult gorillas to their native habitat. While returning to camp, they re-encountered the animals, and one determined to attack. It is best to respond to such an attack by sitting down and remaining passive. The two girls did exactly that, but were still subject to an onslaught by one angry and ungrateful male. For what it's worth, it had some justification, having been released one time previously when younger, and undergoing a serious human assault itself shortly thereafter. In any case, it charged them both and attacked, biting my sister rather severely as she fought it off her partner. That altercation with the gorilla did leave my sister Bonnie with a touch of post-traumatic stress disorder. However, she resolved that quite immediately and returned to her adventures, moving back to London when civil war descended on the Congo. There, she bought a sequence of houses with her husband, renovating each of them and selling them profitably in turn. In her late 30s, however, she finally admitted or discovered that she deeply wanted children. Her husband did not. This was a point of irreconcilable difference, and they divorced, although they stayed on good terms and are still friends. She left and found another husband in due but efficient time thereafter, a man who is a brilliant adventurer in his own right. They soon started a family. Bonnie then transformed from comparatively hard and masculine in her essence, although still charming and attractive, to almost completely motherly and domestic, and just in the nick of time. She told me once of returning to Fairview and relating her adventures to the friends she had left behind. "You are so lucky," they said, one after another. They were correct, in a sense. Terrible things do happen to people, unexpectedly and unfortunately, knocking them off what might otherwise be an exciting and fulfilling path. Bonnie could have fallen prey to some terrible disease, for example, in a manner that would have made any subsequent adventures impossible. She did, in fact, have a serious bout of stomach trouble in the midst of her early efforts, with some attendant surgery. That could well have taken her out. Such things happen to people, and often through no evident fault of their own. There is a random element in life, and providence is in some sense operating at every moment when absolute catastrophe is not rampaging forward. So luck was, as her envious friends insisted, indeed on her side. But in another, and perhaps more fundamental way, what was on Bonnie's side was not luck at all. Or, perhaps, luck is more likely to come the way of the prepared and daring. Her adventures were certainly a consequence of her willingness to say yes, to throw herself on the pyre, and to let what was not meet, good, and proper in her burn away. That was her courageous heeding of conscience and the call. She sacrificed both her childhood and her parents when she left home the second time, as she later realized with some real pain, as all who leave must. And my parents were wise enough to be thrilled that she did so. That means they were willing, like Abram, by then Abraham, in the matter of Isaac, which we will soon discuss, to consecrate their child to God. Like Abraham, however, my parents' willingness to sacrifice their child also meant that she was returned to them. After Bonnie left home, she maintained excellent relations with my mom and dad and took them on many adventures to Africa and elsewhere in their later years. All of that was to the good. God, in the story of Abram, is the spirit that calls to the privileged and sheltered to leave the comforts of their home and to undertake the adventure of their life. Do you abide by that spirit? You were privileged and sheltered, at least to some degree, as a child, as my sister was, as well we all had to be, lest we curl up and die. Nonetheless, or even because of that, something called you out, however minimally, into the world. You abide by some set of principles, regardless of what you do. That abiding is your belief. You are an imitative animal. You have emulated something. You might not know what it is. It might well have been a confused mishmash of somethings. You might not have consciously chosen it or them, not at the highest level of conceptualization. But none of that means you were not emulating. And that was your life. Was it enough? Were you a credit to yourself or your parents? Were you a blessing or a curse to the world? Did you father nations? Or did you instead hide your light under a bushel? What chasm in the structure of reality did your failure to bring everything you had into the world produce? And is it true that you will be held to eternal account for that refusal? These are the truly hard questions of consciousness. 6.2, the devil at the crossroads. After he leaves Egypt, Abram and his nephew Lot, who has been traveling with him, find it necessary to part ways. They are both thriving, but can no longer manage their affairs jointly. What does this mean? That people accompany us as we make our way through our lives, and they become close to us, but our parting with them is inevitable and must be managed, hopefully with goodwill, whether they are friends, entrepreneurial and creative partners, or family members. We are therefore called on to prepare ourselves and our children for that eventuality, accustoming us and them both to loss, developing the ability to derive out of that loss the next steps forward, buttressing and strengthening what remains, reaching out for new connections, maintaining our equilibrium, or even improving our situations. Abram travels west, Lot east. The latter's decision turned him towards Sodom, and therefore in an unholy direction. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves, the one from the other. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Genesis 13:10-13. Abram stays in the vicinity of Bethel, yet again renewing his covenant with God, who repeats and extends his previous promise. Why is that promise extended? It is something in keeping with the so-called Pareto or power distribution, in keeping with the so-called Matthew principle, well understood by economists, the principle that governs the inevitably and radically unequal distribution that characterizes much of the provisioning of the world, social, natural, and divine. For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. Matthew 25:29. Success breeds success, as it does so often, and Abram's faith is rewarded. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever, and I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. Genesis 13:14-18. Abundance is dependent on truly courageous moral action, on genuine faith and forthrightness. This is forever the deepest of truths. The opposite is also true. Satan himself eternally stands at every crossroads, as noted previously, as a crossroads is a decision point, as is a parting of ways. Those who genuinely choose up at such moments head up, God willing, while those who choose down, however inadvertently, head down. In doing so, they choose the desert or the tyranny over the land of plenty, and that regardless of the intrinsic fruitfulness of the land, as we shall later see. The great kings of the vicinity fall to war, the first in the biblical narrative, and Lot is taken captive along with all his possessions and people. This is held to be, traditionally, precisely because he turned, pitched his tent towards Sodom, held to be an evil, materialistic, worldly, and corrupt city. This means, first, that Lot deviated from the true path of adventure when tempted toward what was immediately and foolishly attractive. Second, it means that those who turn from God, which is what Lot does when he breaks with Abram, immediately fall prey to the war of the great kings, the battle between principalities, many of which are dark, that inevitably arises in the absence of what should be properly highest. And the Vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Genesis 14:10-12. Such kings can be well regarded as lesser uniting forces, power and hedonistic pleasure foremost among them, resentment, hatred, jealousy, and other vices also vying for primacy. War breaks out when the superordinate structure that holds things together in peace or in a peace collapses or is abandoned or betrayed. This is equivalent to the death of God. The factions that tear at a culture's heart are kingships. This factional war always rages, and people are always falling prey to it. Abram faces it forthrightly, transforming himself into a warrior when that becomes necessary. When Lot becomes the slave of these lesser forces, a fate he sets up for himself by wandering off the golden path, his uncle rises to the occasion, transforming himself radically once again. Abram arms his trained servants, some 300 in number, and sets out to rescue his brother. Is the willingness and ability to engage in such conflict validly part of heeding God's call? Peace may well be the proper goal of those who are truly upward-aiming and wise, the productive peace of a well-tended garden. But submission to tyranny or participation in hedonistic chaos is not thereby to be abided. Sometimes, trusting in God means preparing for and engaging in battle. Are we not morally obliged in some circumstances to rescue our lost brothers, for example, when the tyrants have come for them, even if that is the result of some error on the part of our kin? If such responsibility is not upheld, is it not true that the same tyrants eventually threaten everyone? And this can happen far faster than might comfortably be imagined. There is no difference in such situations, therefore, between rescuing our brothers and coming to the aid of our future selves, or between such rescue and the stabilization of society itself. That is the iron law of iterative reciprocity, a significant component of friendship and community itself. Abram retrieved all the goods, as well as his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the rest of the people. Genesis 14:16. Afterward, he meets with the very king of Sodom, the leader of a dark principality indeed, who offers him the opportunity to profit from the spoils of war. But Abram replied to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord God, Most High, Creator of heaven and earth, that I will not accept even a thread or a strap of a sandal or anything that belongs to you, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share for the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. They may take their portion." Genesis 14:22-24. Abram wants nothing whatsoever to do with gains that might be ill-gotten. He is no war profiteer. Furthermore, he has no interest whatsoever in being beholden in reality or in reputation to the king of the corrupt state. Accepting even a hypothetically no-strings-attached donation from someone brings with it the liability of, if not outright ownership by that donor, subsequent self-serving rationalization of the act, and a strong tilt thereafter in the direction of the corrupt leader. He must be a good man if I took money from him. That is a great moral danger. I could put the dirty money to good use. Poses even greater peril. Once you convince yourself that you had good reasons for doing something morally unjustifiable, you have fallen prey to the temptation to use God's name in vain, Exodus 20:7, or to pray self-righteously and narcissistically in public, Matthew 6:5-6. There is little worse than a sin justified with the claim of moral virtue, an apropos warning for our dismal and wayward times. This is the reason, to say it again, that God places cherubs and a terrible burning and twisting sword at the gate of paradise to guard the way to the tree of life. Nothing less than Edenic can, by definition, be allowed in the truly heavenly realm. If it were, then heaven itself would be lesser for the admission. 6.3. Life as sacrificial succession. God amplifies his promised reward yet again as a consequence of Abram's latest triumph over temptation and the requisite sacrifice he has voluntarily made. Genesis 15:1-17. Throughout the text, there is a progression in sacrificial quality and reward thereof. The choices laid before Abram improve as his adventure proceeds. His judgment improves in lockstep as his experience accumulates. This makes him ever more proficient at discrimination, judgment, and evaluation, at separating the wheat from the chaff, Matthew 13:24-30, or the sheep from the goats, Matthew 25:31-32. This means that he becomes a forever polished reflection of the Logos as he develops. That might well be understood as a definition of upward development itself, as a representation of its essence, which is no different in principle from union with or possession by God himself, as one of the prime reasons for the reality of the recently mentioned Matthew principle. This is indicated, ritualized, and solemnized in the events that occur in the immediate aftermath of the war from which Abram refused to profit. God first says, "Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." Genesis 15:1. These are very specific words, indicating something equally specific, that walking the proper path is both the best possible strategy of defense, keeping the terrors of life and the negative emotion associated with catastrophe most effectively at bay, but also the golden road itself, leading to the eternal land of milk and honey. And he said, "Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it?" And he said unto him, "Take me an ephah of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon." And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, and laid each piece one against another. But the birds divided he not. And when the fowls came down upon the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Abram, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaims and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. Genesis 15:8-21. The sacrifice is ritualized and solemnized in this case by the offering of three animals and two birds, on which the Spirit of God descends in the form of flame and smoke, passing through the divided carcasses, indicating divine approval of the covenant. What precisely is a covenant? A contract between two parties who agree to undertake or refrain from undertaking certain acts. A contract. Compact, deal, or bargain. Why is the relationship with the source of being itself conceptualized as contractual? The answer is found in the nature of work itself, as intimated previously. Actions in the present, sacrificial actions, will pay off in the future. Work is therefore a bargain with the future, a promissory note offered by God. If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. Genesis 4:7. It is also in the nature of relationship. The conscience that speaks from within does not compel or force. Instead, it speaks as counsel, but it must be listened to. The story of Cain and Abel relates God's rejection of Cain's second-rate sacrifices, an occurrence that leaves Cain with a choice. He can change, pull on his boots, and set forward to do things right, or he can turn toward Sodom, so to speak, drift downward into resentment and bitterness, shake his fist at God and his injustice, and set the stage for bloody mayhem. Abel's wayward, tyrannical, and jealous brother determines to continue offering the wrong sacrifices, as we have seen, refusing to offer the best he has in the present, compromising not only his own future, but that of his descendants and the broader community. In doing so, Cain does worse than abandon God. He establishes a relationship of enmity with him. Implicit in the story of the original hostile brothers is the insistence that a relationship with the divine is inevitable. The only question is its nature. This is at least in part because the human being is a personality, and personalities by their nature exist in relationship, contract, agreement, negotiation, or covenant to what they encounter. Is the fact that each of us is a personality not an indication that personality is what in fact faces the world and in relationship with it? And if that is true, and what part of it is not, then specifying and clarifying the nature of that relationship must be the primary goal of all our deepest endeavors to understand and to adapt. Cain could treat the eternal spirit of being and becoming as a father, ally, and guiding spirit, offering to it, as to an admired leader, his very best. He could accept full responsibility for his problems, no matter how large or even how evidently unfair, pick up his bloody cross and stumble, however badly and erroneously, uphill. Alternatively, he could step forward in distrust, keeping his best for his narrow present self and treating the God eternally unimpressed by such reserve as an enemy. Cain is he who then and forever chooses the latter route, inviting in the devil himself and embodying the very pattern of the eternal adversary. Everyone faces the same choice every time a choice is made. The world lays itself out as the direct consequence of such choice. Abram, the descendant of Seth and not of Cain, makes the correct sacrifices, establishes a productive relationship with the still small voice within, and has the redemptive adventure of his life. It is not by chance that his story is the first after the catastrophes of the flood of chaos and rise of the totalitarian state. He is the individual whose mode of being and becoming eternally sets things right. This setting right includes ensuring the success, a success that is both radical and lasting, of his progeny. Why the insistence in the text on the fate of his descendants? That is a strange question indeed, in a time so heavily influenced by Darwin and Freud, to say nothing of the French postmodernist Michel Foucault, by some measures the world's most cited shudder scholar. In a time when the primacy of the sexual impulse, the drive to reproduce, is held to be paramount in the realm of private motivation, as well as the determining purpose of life as such. Even the biologists, who should know better, are mainly on board with this. The famous selfish gene cares for nothing, for example, but replication at any cost, or so goes the story. Could it not be possible, however, and instead, that the interests of the individual truly pursuing his or her great adventure do and must align perfectly with the demands of procreation, all things considered and wisely understood? This would mean a harmony from instinct to heaven, so to speak, instead of any inevitable and necessary opposition between biological impulse, motivation, or drive, all inadequate conceptualizations, and the social order. No chaotic Hobbesian war of all against all, a Rousseauian antithesis of society and noble savage. The path that God has offered to Abram is that which leads him down the path most likely to make him a father, even under exceptionally difficult conditions, signified by the birth of Isaac, even to his elderly wife, and second, the progenitor of a literal nation, albeit with some intermediating delay. How is that destiny to be understood most broadly? And how does it manifest itself in the particulars of Abram's life? Understanding all this requires a discussion of sex, but in the broadest possible sense, a discussion of sex and the place it plays in life, in blessing and dynasty, privately, immediately, and through the span of generations. 6.4, sex and parasitism. Women choose men who are adventurous and able. They are attracted first and foremost by competence and confidence. Competence is best marked by, or consists of, two traits. First, the intelligence that is generative and sacrificial in that it produces variant, possibly adaptive selves, and then culls them. Second, by the willingness to abide by contractual obligation or covenant, establish a relationship with tradition, and delay gratification, all features associated with the sacrifice of the narrow self to the future, to the community, and to the ideal. This is something that might well be regarded as the capacity for successful apprenticeship. Confidence, for its part, appears primarily marked by the trait markers most tightly associated with masculinity, cross-culturally. At least, low neuroticism or negative emotionality, freedom from anxiety and pain, and perhaps the low agreeableness comprising the ability to disagree with social convention, and to stand one's own ground. The proximal attractiveness of personality to women on the part of men is obviously the minimum precondition for the successful bringing forth of children. That means that even in the most immediate manner, the capacity for relationship is the precondition for reproduction, and therefore for adaptation, in the sense that the evolutionary biologists typically mean when they use that word. But survival itself, in the multi-generational manner most relevant, say, to the Darwinists, is by no means merely a matter of proximate sexual attractiveness or prowess. If that were the case, then so-called short-term mating strategies would be the human norm and ideal, and that is clearly not the case. They are, however, markedly more effective than no strategy at all. That can make those who employ them, typically the quasi-psychopathic dark tetrad personality types, charismatically attractive to those too timid, immature, or dependent to try at all, not least because in their immaturity, such individuals cannot discriminate between the false confidence of the narcissist or the psychopath and the true confidence of the genuinely competent and able. This is no indication, however, that manipulative, predatory, or parasitic approaches to the problems and opportunities of mating, or that those who employ them can or should be regarded as optimal in any fundamental manner, whether considered at the individual, social, or natural levels of analysis. Long-term monogamous strategies are therefore not only the human norm, cross-culturally speaking, but also the correct ideal. The sacrificial and expansive adventure of Abram is thus best understood not only as the conduct that makes him an attractive mate, but the pattern he embodies and passes on to his children in the form of the continuing mimetic tradition, rendering his progeny successful across the generations to follow. This is the pattern of the wise father, not the pattern of the manipulative psychopath who manages to delude women and himself into sequential trysts. No less a figure than God himself points this out, insisting to Abram that the two of them are playing the long game. God even indicates that Abram's descendants will struggle for four generations before emerging triumphant. And he said unto Abram, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance." Genesis 15:13-14. There is an overwhelming relationship between male attractiveness to women, particularly as a long-term partner, and genuine ability. That is, the ability to pathfind in the world to acquire necessary resources, which can be both material and spiritual, and to share them judiciously and effectively with others. Good men engage in long rather than short-term mating strategies. The best men, following Abram's example, employ the longest-term and most comprehensive strategies possible. What does all this mean? Nothing less than that the pathway to ultimate reproductive success among men is the same faithful pathway trod by those who remain loyal, all in, to the dictates of the animating spirit that establishes the order that is good, calls to adventure, and unites and fortifies psychologically and socially. It is all the same thing. That is, of course, the monotheistic insistence, however implicitly. Although sex is obviously a precondition for reproduction, sex and reproduction are by no means identical, particularly and especially not among human beings, who are long-lived, high-investment maters and multi-generational caretakers. Thus, the most effective reproductive strategy is hardly that of the selfish gene. What then of women? Sarai, Abram's wife, is famously barren until old age, and then she somewhat miraculously conceives, as we shall see. Genesis 17:15-17. What does this mean? First of all, conception is always somewhat miraculous, and is experienced as such, at least when it is desired and appropriate. Second, it is also the case for women that the divine pathway is the best strategy, all things considered, for successful partnership and reproductive success. Nothing is certain in life, not least the desired outcome regarding children, but women who retain their virtue, to use the old-fashioned terminology, and orient themselves in the direction of so-called long-term mating strategies, are much more likely to be chosen as partners by men aiming at the same thing. Men genuinely seeking for classically virtuous women, which is what genuinely seeking actually means, as opposed to preying upon, are also typically those who want the particular woman they are pursuing to find and adopt her desired role as genuine mate and